Weaknesses?
Major weaknesses.
The major weaknesses in the Rockefeller Organization or the Rockefeller Administration were a lack of control, enough control over what was going on in various state agencies. In the process of trying to make them independent, he made them, allowed them to become so autonomous that they set up little fiefdoms, really, and competed with each other in some respects. And as a consequence of that, I'm not sure state government was as well organized, even with governmental reorganization, in practice as it was in principle. Now, the principles he installed, so to speak, in his reorganization effort, I think, are being adhered to a great deal more religiously now than they were during his administration. Another weakness was, as we talked about, his inability to get along with the legislature, and as a consequence of many of the great programs or good programs that he devised, never got off the shelves. I mean, the Silverfish, you know, had a field day with Rockefeller's administration because there were lots of studies and proposals and programs that never saw the light of day because he could not get along with the legislature after that first term. After the honeymoon was over, it was just downhill in that respect.
Did Bumpers pick up many of those programs?
Yes, he did. He did.
What would be some specifics?
Well, I think mainly the governmental reorganization area, the Bumpers took that and enlarged on it and polished it and made a hell of a better, more workable program out of the whole thing than Rockefeller ever did or ever could have, really. Bumpers, in my view, originated very little during his 4 years. Really, most of what he did was I hope that didn't sound like sour grapes. He took Rockefeller's things and made them work for Rockefeller. Just about everything he did, with the exception of a wilderness program. He wouldn't create wilderness areas in Arkansas. Bumpers did. He lost that fight in Lakeslands, but Rockefeller had nothing to do with that. We didn't have any involvement in that. But prison reform, Bumpers picked up where Rockefeller left off, carried on with that, made it work better than Rockefeller did. It's not there, as I say, but he did that. He fought the same people Rockefeller did. Senator Jones right here in Conway and some of the other power structure guys. Bumpers, philosophically, very close to Rockefeller. And we'll tell you some stuff. They weren't far apart at all on just about anything. Thought a lot alike. Rockefeller, if he had to give it up, and he hated like hell to give it up the way he did, but if he had to, that's the guy to take it. Dale Bumpers couldn't have asked for it. He couldn't have ordered a more perfect successor than Dale Bumpers. We were talking about some weaknesses a minute ago, and I was going to say another weakness, I think, was Rockefeller's remoteness from the day-to-day job. That's kind of complicated, but Faubus was a man who was there at 9 o'clock in the morning all day in the door, and people coming in and out. The business of state government was run right there in the governor's office in the Capitol. He was very visible. And so Rockefeller, on the other hand, liked to be at Winrock. He mentioned he liked privacy. Very shy. Could not stand crowds. Lots of people crowding around. He couldn't stand that. He did not like that. He avoided it when he could. Campaigning was just an awful thing for him, man. He would just sweat and tremble when he was going to speak. It just went against his grain to campaign. And he hated to do it, and if you look at his campaigns, the 64 campaign, it was his best effort because he made the greatest physical effort. He got out there and pressed the flesh, you know, in and out of the little flat little cafes and the parades and the picnics and up and down the streets of small town Arkansas. 66 campaign, he backed up a step, a little more radio and TV. More airplanes between towns rather than driving, fewer delegations that he would receive in the hotel room, more of his staff he'd take with him, the people he was comfortable with and familiar with.
he was going to be working on state problems in the 68 campaign. Still more remote, still a step back even further now. He just makes a few speeches. He has regional rallies. He didn't go out there and go up down those streets. And he announces, I'm not going to campaign like I did in 64 and 66. And 70 campaign man, one of the big plans that we shot down with great effort was he wanted to campaign from a helicopter with a loudspeaker. Really, that was his idea. He wanted to fly over town and announce stuff. I mean, he just, really, I mean, I'm painting a more vivid picture maybe than you, but I think if you read through all the material, you would see this trend of just stepping back one step at a time away from that physical, sweaty handshake stuff. He just, it was not his thought. And he was remote in that respect. He liked privacy. He would surround himself with a few aides and people at night, spend hours away from his appointments. Business of being governor. He did not like being governor in respect at all. He liked those programs and he wanted to do those things that he'd set out to do, but the day-to-day routine, nitty-gritty, checklist, call this person, tell him no, tell him yes, he hated it and avoided it. Just incredibly.
Didn't that increasingly show towards the end of
the country? Yes, it did. Yes, it did. There was more. As a matter of fact, the media would keep tabs on how many hours he was spending in the office and so on, you know, and they would broadcast it and announce it. Whether Rockefeller spent, you know, 14 minutes and 8 seconds in his office this week or something like that, you know, it was, oh, and he resented the hell out of it, but there's nothing he could do about that. He was kind of I still can't figure it out. He was an extremely complex man. I'm not kidding. He really was. He just layers of complexity. Paradoxes just apparent in everything. For example, as I say, he treasured his privacy and sought it for it. And on the other hand, he would talk about things in public of the most private nature. His life, his domestic life, his relationship to his wife, liking for the hard stuff, you know. I mean, he just didn't make any bones about any of that. I mean, he tried to be. I mean, his private life he made laid bare practically to a fault. And on the other hand, he would just
try to keep his public life private.
It was unbelievable, and we never could. I couldn't figure out what he. It's just some personality quirk. I don't know. He was a curious man, I respect. Very, very hard to figure out.
At the time, in those years that he's withdrawing more and more from the public life and trying to be private, is the reverse occurring the other way? Is he laying more and more out of his private life when he does appear in public?
Well, I'd say that's not bad. I'd say so, yes. He, as a matter of fact, one incident that really popped in mind when you said that was there was a much celebrated situation with lots of publicity where he and his wife, Jeanette, were at the Warren Pink Tomato Festival, and she reportedly slapped him right there in public. You know, they had a big confrontation in the back seat of the car before they were whisked away, and so on. Then his divorce with Jeanette, of course, was, that was handled privately, but I mean, it was a big thing to public. They knew it was coming before the election. He, in the 70 campaign, he just sort of, the trend that I described, the paradox in a way, I think by the 70 campaign, he was beginning to just pull back everything. Just real curious kind of remoteness. He had been shot down 11 times before the election. He'd gone in there with all those damn programs. He'd spent money of his own on them. He'd had experts, had them researched, he'd go in there and present them, and boom, you know, they just turn him down, all that stuff. More and more, they just didn't care. And one time in particular, he had them over to the mansion for breakfast, some of them, on a particular piece of legislation. He was reluctant to do it in the first place. But we just insisted because he had to meet with these guys. They came over and, as he says, broke bread and had this warm breakfast, he thought. two cups of coffee and so on, and they went back over to the legislature. See, and he has a little handle and monitor, you know, he could listen to the deliberations in his office, and he flicks it on some guys. I don't remember the words or anything, but the guy was there saying, you know what, that guy, he had us over here this morning, over in the mansion, see, the guys were telling me, yeah, Governor, that sounds real good, boy, that's fine, yeah, oh, yeah, well, I think the folks up here, they like it. Then they get in the legislature and they make fun of him, you know, as they shoot him down on it and say, man, that guy couldn't accept it, he didn't understand it. They broke bread with me, see, I mean, and it was just a personal hurt, it was not just a cynical politician, you know, playing both ends against the middle. It was a personal insult to him. Just like when they came to the farm and took away the stuff, that was a personal insult. See, that was, he said, but this is my home, see. He sees it as home. Most guys, like most other people, see it as kind of an institution, this big thing up there. It's kind of like a motel, you know, 80, 11 rooms. They don't think of it as a home, but he does. And that was the way with the legislature. And the guys coming over to the mansion, they broke bread with him, and then whatever they say there ought to be, a man's word, as he says, ought to be as good as his bond, ought to be his bond. And that brings me to one of the great, tremendous problems that he had in the Senate election. He had said, see, he would not seek a third term. He published it in his Statement of Beliefs, which was a very popular campaign document, the first three campaigns. I forgot which number it was, maybe it was one of 16 principles. I will not, you know, under any circumstances, seek a third term as governor. Then he ran for a third term, so he couldn't live with that himself. It really created problems for him.
Why did he do that?
It's a curious thing. A lot of people say that we made the decision for him or encouraged him, but that's not true. He made the decision, and I tell you why he made it. He had come into state politics in the first place when Orville Faubus was king. And Orville Faubus was everything Rockefeller didn't like. He was old guard. He was the big money boys around him. He was using the boards and commissions to protect these guys instead of the other way around. I mean, it was just the classic case of a despot in power with a few guys around him he was taking care of, at least as far as Rockefeller was concerned. So that was all he was. Well, he went in there against Orville Faubus. He ran against Faubus in 64, and of course he really ran against him in 66, even though his opponent was somebody else. I mean, it just, and we were all tooled up for Faubus' son. Anyway, he finally, Faubus didn't run in 66 because he was going to get beat, at least our survey showed him. Rockefeller was going to win in 66, almost regardless. And certainly he was going to beat Orville Faubus. Well, so we went in office, and Rockefeller felt that he had won out over Orville Faubus. And he had, really. He had won out over Faubus. He had forced Orville not to run again. And then Faubus got involved in his opponent's campaign in the latter stages to no avail. But Rockefeller felt like he had defeated Faubus. Okay, he goes on and serves his 4 years. He's going to do these things that he promised he's going to have this. And he does some of them. Then he's ready to leave office. And who should pop up on the horizon there but the symbol of everything he'd been fighting against and the reason that he got in there? Orville Faubus. Here's Orville coming back into politics. Orville runs. See, Orville's going to run for governor again. That's why Rockefeller ran for third term. Because it looked then, see, that Orville was going to get the nomination. Nobody had ever heard of Dale Bumpers. Who the hell is Dale Bumpers? I mean, he was nobody. Zero. He had no recognition rating, nothing. You couldn't find anybody that ever heard of Dale Bumpers. In the beginning there was no way to predict that. It was just Faubus. Mr. Old Guard was back on the scene, and W.R. just decided, by God, he wouldn't go and said, okay, Orville, I've had my 4 years, now here, you take it back. He just wouldn't go and do that. That's the way he felt about it. And that's why he ran. It was a great mistake for him personally, because what it did to him to break his own word. Hell, he was on record. It was in print. It wasn't just a... And I gave him, before he made that final decision, Walter, I went through all my files, And I gave him a list of every time he said he would not run for third term. I documented the place and date. It was about 50 times. I gave it to him about 3 pages, single-spaced. You know, just I just wanted to know that he had said it all that many times. But he didn't matter.
There was a Lorville over there. And
he wasn't going to hand it back to him. And really, to everyone, it looked like this was, that Orville was going to have it easily. Because he had never been defeated then, so he was... He still had that mystique, and he still had that cloud, everyone thought. And, that's what did it, more than anything else. Because he did not enjoy being governor. He did not enjoy being governor. He had not finished his job, as he says, and there was Orville, and that's what he wanted to do.
Have you seen this book?
No, I have not read that. I think Dale mentioned that book to me.
He's talking in here about Faubus and the Little Rock crisis. And he says, Faubus had been adequately warned about the dangers of physically resisting orders of the federal courts, a step no governor had taken since the Civil War. Winthrop Rockefeller, then on good terms with Faubus as head of the state industrial development effort, had spent 2.5 years with the, 2.5 hours with the governor. Quote, I reasoned with him, argued with him, almost pled with him, close quote, not to intervene, and told him, quote, the local situation was none of his business, Rockefeller said later. Rockefeller also insisted, though Faubus denied, that Faubus told him, quote, I'm sorry, but I'm already committed. I'm going to run for a third term, and if I don't do this, Jim Johnson and Bruce Bennett will tear me to shreds.
I know Rockefeller met with Orville. I don't recall it being anything like 2.5 hours. He did meet with him, and he did encourage him not to take the step he did. Brooks Hayes and a lot of other people did the same thing. I mean, Rockefeller was one of several who did that. And of course, I don't know what Faubus told him, but I can imagine Faubus seeing it. I give him credit for being just that cynical myself. He may not have been, but I see him doping it all out. And Faubus was great at doing what I'm sure y'all have heard in every state of finding where the people are going and leading them there. Faubus was
You accept the interpretation then of Faubus acting as a cynical political leader?
Yes, I do. I certainly do. I think he was just that.
And there's another interpretation that Faubus really thought there was going to be violence and sort of was pushed into a corner and acted.
Well, that may be true, but I don't agree with it myself. But I don't have any real knowledge. I can only make the observation has been working on one of the state newspapers at the time and sort of involved in that respect, but hell, I don't know, you know, I just read it.
Let me ask you this question, John. Knowing Rockefeller very closely as you did and intimately as you did, if Rockefeller in an interview said Faubus told him this, would you have absolute faith in his recollection or something like that?
I wouldn't have faith in him quoting him exactly, but I certainly would. Yes, I would. I'd have faith that he recalled it. Rockefeller had a pretty good memory for that sort of thing because he couldn't read, and he had a hell of a good memory for what you told him. He really did.
He couldn't read.
Could not read at all. He could read, but he was slow and painful. As a matter of fact, he had a case of dyslexia to a mild degree. And he would read numbers all wrong, all the time. He's always been
that. Doesn't Nelson have the same problem?
He may, I don't know.
Yeah.
But Rockefeller definitely had it. he hated to read. You wrote him a memo, you know, really. It took 2 or 3 years to figure this out. But you'd write him this memo that, God, it just was critical, you know, and everything was stamped on him, and he had to do this thing and take his action. He'd put it in his briefcase. And you wouldn't hear back on it. And you would call him and go over it over the phone, and he would just be so... cooperative and helpful, and yes, well, what? All right, fine, that's a good idea, or no, that isn't, or whatever. You'd work it out over the phone, see? And what he did, he'd keep putting those things in his briefcase, and once his secretary discovered he had 9 briefcases under his desk full of those memos. He just wouldn't read them. And I asked him about it, kidding him about it, and he said, you know, you'd be amazed at how few of those things ever amount to a goddamn thing. And he did not like to read, and he had great terror. At first, when we write speeches, and I started out writing speeches. And
is that why you had a problem reading speeches?
Oh, yeah. At first, I thought it was that I wouldn't get his phraseology right, and I'd interview him and tape him so I could get his phraseology, you know, and I'd take those phrases out and glue them into that thing and give it back to him, and he's still. And so I went to larger size type. I had started off with just regular pocket type, and then I went to the IBM Executive, all caps, you know, which is pretty good size type. Gave him that. Same problem. So I remembered that at Williamsburg, they had a speech typewriter. It did pretty good size type. So I called old Don Gonzales up, and he told me where to get one of these things, and I got one of those typewriters. And we put the speech on it. Same problem. So, hell, we got a teleprompter typewriter. Bought the damn thing. I've forgotten how much it cost, but it was a lot. Because we were going to try to borrow the ones for the TV stations that got two in box, so we bought one. Put the damn stuff on that, you can imagine. He still couldn't. And when we figured out, he just couldn't read. It was not the size of the type, although he wouldn't wear glasses if he was supposed to. He didn't wear them. He's very vain about those glasses. He'd just wear them in private, you know. When he got those glasses out and put them on, you were in. I'll guarantee you. If he put those glasses on in your presence, you were with the inside man, because he sure hated to wear them. But he couldn't read.
Well, some interpreted the fact that he couldn't read his speech, the fact that he usually had been drinking too much.
Well, that's not true. Sometimes he had been drinking quite a bit.
But it was because of that eye problem?
Yeah, it wasn't because he was boozed up. And as a matter of fact, he was given credit for being drunk or drinking heavily. Really, a lot of times when he wasn't. I'm not defending him. I mean, he drank in public. He appeared in public having had some drinks when he shouldn't have on many occasions. But many times, he was given credit for being loaded when he wasn't. And I'll tell you why he was given credit for being. Because he was a very emotional man. He really wasn't. He would choke up. He would even cry in public. He was a curious guy. Speech to the legislature. I've seen him really choke up. And he said, boy, that guy's really bombed. But he wasn't. He had not had one drink. I know. He just was emotional and nervous and shy and choked up. And he would give the impression of being loaded, and he wasn't really. But his problem with those speeches, now some of them were poorly done speeches, I'll be frank to tell you. And I'm not going to have to take responsibility for a lot. They weren't what he should have had, because he didn't want to work on them, for one thing. He didn't want to worry with them. He just wanted you to hand him something that was just what he wanted to say, and you couldn't do that. And you'd say, Chief, we've got to get together here, and so on. And he would put it off and postpone it. And you'd talk about it over the phone and so on. And the old clock keeps ticking up. And finally, hell, you've got to get something on paper. And but later, a guy came on the staff. A guy named Charlie Albright, who did real fine. He was really good at picking out a WR the things that he wanted to say and getting them on paper. He was much, much better than anyone else was. And but even at that, Rockefeller, one occasion I know I'm wasting tape, was a great scene to me. Albright, y'all would like, I don't know if either one of you met him, he's a great guy, works for the Gazette now, he's gone back to the Gazette. Excellent writer, really. Sharp as hell. He worked on this damn speech. It was a big fundraising dinner. It was a Republican fundraising dinner, and Everett Dirksen was there, as I recall. Martin Coliseum, hell, there was going to be all kinds of action there, supposedly. And all the Rockefeller folks are going to be there paying their dues out of loyalty to WR, so to speak. And Albright worked on his speech, and it was terrific. It was great. It really was. Really had some good stuff in it. He had dug out. Oh, he had gone back through 10 years of vital speeches of the day and stolen stuff from there, and gathered up a lot of good original stuff too. And you know, he put the thing all together. Boy, it was a dandy speech. And WR had a couple of drinks before the thing. You know, Dirksen, I guess he was wanting to imbibe himself a tad. And WR walked out of the for all these people, and the lights were on. Reached in his inside coat pocket, and he pulled out his speech toward me. He said, my speech writer's prepared this one for you. You can imagine the little speech you made on the front end, but I want to speak, God, it was just awful. And then he launched into this speech. It was just terrible. It was just rambling and so on. And he did the same thing at Williamsburg. The big, the Washington Press Club, we're having the meeting in Williamsburg. He wanted me to go up with him, and I did. And Williamsburg sent down Gonzales and the guy that writes the books for Williamsburg up there came down. He's a hell of a good speech writer, I forgot his name. Came down and the speeches had to be just right. As you probably know, Lyndon Johnson was there, Dean Rusk, everybody was there. I mean, man, it was, you know, if they had dropped a bomb there, man, it would have wiped out the federal government. I mean, the big guys were there, including the president. And they, you know, dutifully read their little speeches. It was 2.5 to 3 minutes worth of real light, crisp stuff, you know, and that was the whole idea of it. And they worked with WR, and they had a beauty. Boy, it was about 3 minutes worth of great stuff. He got up there, and Lyndon preceded him, did his just right. Earl Warren was on the thing. You know, hell, it was just terrific. WR got up there, and he never referred to that. He made about a 20-minute speech on faultless, and off into various directions and so on. And he was hard sometimes to tell the truth, too. I always tried to, and sometimes I didn't, but most of the time I did, I think. We were flying back on his plane, and he said, and I could tell he knew, but he asked me, he said, well, how was my speech? I said, it was a bomb. He said, no, I thought that. He said, I was afraid that it was. He just wouldn't read or something. I don't know. He just never did read speeches. The only ones he delivered with any real good what were speeches that he sort of memorized, gone over several times, so he kind of had it. That's true.
In other words, when he was drinking enough to be affected by it, that compounded with his
that
natural proclivity, it came off really bad. Is that right?
That's right. If he would try to tell jokes. He had a great sense of humor, but he didn't have the sense of humor that most people have, and his jokes were just, you know, they wouldn't even know he was at the end of it. It wouldn't make sense, and they wouldn't know whether to laugh or not, and he would cue him, you know, and now for a bit of levity, he finally learned to do that, and then he would go into this whole thing, and everybody knew that they were supposed to laugh. Beautiful guy.
How important was his money, A, in his elections, and B, in the administration?
Well, that's a real good question. His money was vital to his election, I think, even though you can win elections with not much dough, maybe. Dale Bumpers, by comparison to Fulbright, certainly did that, I think. I think Rockefeller was able to assemble an organization because of his money that I think his organization had a lot to do with winning it for him. And in his administration, he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars right out of his own pocket for things for the state of Arkansas. Unbelievable, really. That story alone, there's a hell of a good story right there. I don't know what it means exactly, but the guy was extremely generous to the state. And, you know, you don't give money to a state. I mean, what the hell? It's, you know, you don't see the light in somebody's eyes of gratitude when you hand them a 10 spot. I mean, it's just like throwing it off in the Grand Canyon almost, to me. But, man, he spent hundreds of thousands of dollars doing stuff. And not to make himself look good. I don't mean that. I mean just doing things, programs and studies and so on that he wasn't even really going to get much credit for.
What are some examples?
Well, I tell you, the Constitutional Convention was one thing. God almighty, he spent a ton of dough on
that. Did he finance that himself?
Yes, he did. He financed a study of state government before he took office, a tremendous study of state government by Pete Marwick Mitchell and Company. It was under the auspices of the Committee for the Two-Party System, but WR picked up the tab on that thing, man, and it was a ton of money.
How much is a ton?
Oh, back then, I imagine that study cost $35,000, $40,000. It was a lot back then. That was in 63, you know. Be about like 60 now, probably. But it was, that figure would be available. But it was a lot of dough. He did that many times over, many different things, studies. He would hire, for example, he would hire, and did hire, a staff, if you want to call it that, of lawyers, to help prepare, really do a good job on legislation for him to propose. I mean, he would tell them what he wanted, and they would go to work on it. Man, they'd send him bills that would choke a horse, you know, retainer stuff. On the Game and Fish Commission investigation alone, Rockefeller hired an attorney who in turn got some staff folks together. I'll bet you he spent $100,000 on that. Really? Of his own money. To benefit nobody except he believed in that, and there was no other way to do it. And so he went after it to clean up the Game and Fish Commission.
So it was critical.
What did you pose in 1970 to show as the reason that the new Constitution failed?
I really am ashamed that the polls are not more definitive than they are. Walter Nunn, here while back, wanted the questions, and I got them for him out of the archives up there on the poll questions on that. Really,
did you know by the time of the election it wasn't going to pass?
Yeah, pretty much. We thought it was a toss-up. It turned out it wasn't much of a toss-up. The reason is, in my view, and just kind of generalizing over what the polls showed, as a matter of fact, people gave it lip service even right at the last day. Yeah, you know, they thought a new Constitution would be a very wonderful thing. The truth is, they did not understand it. They did not know really what it was going to do to them. And we couldn't explain. I mean, you know, it takes 10,000 words to explain one thing, and then one detractor, the people that were against the right to work or whatever, could shoot it down in just a few words. And it had enemies who did not like certain provisions, certain limited provisions in it, and the selling of it. It was just never sold in a way that people could believe that their life was going to be improved by passing this thing, by okaying it. And because they didn't know for sure what damage it might do, and because they couldn't see how it was going to really help them personally, they weren't for it. I mean, Rockefeller had this problem in his own campaign. The same, I often used it as an example, I think, correctly. So he would be out there with his foot on the fence talking to a farmer, and W.R. would be explaining his road program for Arkansas in answer to that farmer's question about what Rockefeller was going to do about that chucko out there. It was tearing up his pickup. I mean, Rockefeller would give him this, and he was right. He'd give him this overall program, and here's all this. That guy didn't give a damn about that. What are you going to do for me right now, here, right out there, 3 feet from me? And that's the way it was with the Constitution. We did not sell it in a way that people could see any advantage for themselves. And that's what I, just looking back on it.
Was there a failure in selling it?
Yeah, I don't think it was sold well. And of course, I don't think, we made a great effort. And I think the people that were right at the forefront and visible of the Constitution would validate what I'm saying. We made a great effort for Rockefeller to stay away from it to a great extent, because we felt that would create problems for him if he were too much involved with it. Because all our polls, it looked very grim for Rockefeller after Bumpers won the runoff, of course. And I think that people in Arkansas, I guess, to sum up about that, maybe they're this way in every other state. If they can't see any advantage, they're against it. They really are. They just don't want to make a change unless they can see some direct benefit. I don't know if they're that way in other states or not, but that's what people are. So they're selfish in that respect.
Would you say
then why they vote for Bumpers and not Rockefeller?
Rockefeller was represented far too many negatives. He was embarrassing to them. They had decided that he was he drank too much. And
does this come up in your polls?
Yeah. And the main one of the problems in Walter is, when I was talking about this earlier, he turned the light on, as I say, and made people look at government they didn't really want to look all that much. And they didn't want all that controversy between him and the legislature. They were sick and tired of that. They didn't want to pick up the paper every day because they had to kind of think about it and they had to kind of make a decision about it. You know, if it's there every day, you got to do something about it. And they didn't want to think about it. They didn't want to think about the prisons, really. They didn't want to know what was going on down there. They just wanted to forget all about that. And he represented controversy, constant controversy and turmoil, which he did. And they just got up to here with all that. And bumpers, they thought Mr. Bland glossed it all over. He turned out to be far more vigorous and effective, I think, than they probably thought he would. But Rockefeller was just controversy. He did force people to think. And I think things are considerably better because of that, but that didn't mean they lacked it.
How about on industrial development, John? Two questions. One, did industrial development really slow down in Arkansas after Little Rock in 57? And did it really turn around after Rockefeller became governor?
I think yes. As a matter of fact, the record is clear that it slowed down tremendously after the Little Rock racial crisis. Hell, the figures are there, boy. I mean, it just dipped to nothing practically. You can confirm that with the AIDC figures, as a matter of fact, and they'd be glad to share those with you. Rockefeller, prior to that time, of course, had been the chairman of the AIDC. He was not, he was elected, really, by the commissioners, as I recall. I don't think Fabus really appointed him chairman. He appointed him to the commission. A lot of people think he appointed him chairman. He didn't. I think the commissioners elected him chairman, although I think Faubus was favorable to it. During that first 4 or 5 years, Rockefeller built that thing like crazy. He really did. He worked his ass off. There again, he got money out of his own pocket and poured into that damn thing. He brought in people. He brought in old Bill Ewald from Washington, who was a development consultant type guy. He brought in Bill Rock, who was with Con Edison, who was a development type guy, and between those two and some others, professionals, they really put it together. They really did create all these 90,000 new jobs that we put in our campaign literature. It's true, they did. And then Faubus resigned in 64, early 64, when he knew he was going to run for governor. They had tried to get him before then, and had failed because he was very popular. A move started in the legislature, which Faubus fed allowed to develop to shoot Rockefeller down. What they wanted to do was dissolve that thing and reform it without Rockefeller, because the legislators could see Rockefeller becoming powerful, and you know, they could see him as using that thing for his own personal political ambition, and they didn't want him to get any stronger. But the public reaction was overwhelming. Telegrams and stuff. There was a little organized campaign, I think, but I wasn't involved at the time. Anyway, in 64, Rockefeller's out of the AIDC. I really don't believe that the program slowed down very much when Rockefeller was no longer chairman. I don't recall exactly, but I don't think it slowed down very much. I think it's continued to grow ever since it made its recovery after the racial thing. I think the trend has been pretty good. While Rockefeller was governor, it was great. It did fine. Plants came in and so on. They continue to do so under bumpers. I don't know that Rockefeller's being governor speeded up the process all that much. I know it certainly didn't hurt. It probably helped some. But so has bumpers helped. Rockefeller and bumpers both have been positive, I'd say, generally positive influences. And both have, I think Rockefeller in particular gave Arkansas, I think he helped Arkansas's image quite a bit nationally. I think people in Arkansas think that and felt that way at the time. And I think Bumpers has done the same thing. But Rockefeller always, ever since I've known him, was really oriented to industrial development. He liked that, industrial economic development. Well, he talked about it a lot. And he really worked. Probably worked harder at that than he ever has in his life, with more effectiveness too, I'd say.
What about his son?
Went to Paul is back. He's out of school. He spent a year at 9 months really at
TCU, I guess. There's a program in...
No.
Who was that? I don't know. Anyway, it was a program in animal husbandry, kind of a crash course for management type personnel. He's back at the farm now, and he's somewhat interested in politics, although he's not ready to get bombed yet, I don't think. He's going to be a Republican. He's not good for the party. Some of the party folks I know are eyeing him as a source of...
One of the scenarios is that down the road, 5-10 years, that he lends his name and his wealth and his prestige and all that to another candidacy, and we bring back the Camelot.
Yeah, a lot of folks.
2A.
A lot of folks are counting that. They really think that's going to happen.
Is that realistic?
I think it might be possible. I talked to him about it. I went up to his last birthday party here not too long ago, and I haven't been around too much since I left a couple of times, and then this time, and we had a chance to talk for maybe an hour, I guess, just closely. And I asked him about all that stuff. Well, he's really careful about committing himself on anything. He's not sure just exactly when or how he might get involved politically. He is interested in it. And, I'm not sure I don't think it's just because his father, although he's tried to do some of the things his father had started, I'm not sure his interest would not be just his own personal interest. I don't think it's bringing back something his father was trying to put together. I'd say it's possible that 5, 6, 7 years he might get involved. Yeah.
Should we try to interview him, or it's just...
We were sitting in the public relations office once, and I had never commented to him, and never did, about how happy or unhappy his life might be, but sometimes he would talk about his life. His life as a child, his life as a family. I had read all the correspondence between he and his family. His father always signed his letters "Father," you know. And they were more memos than they were letters. I mean, you could see problems on both sides of that thing. But Wynn would say, and he said, and he meant this. He said his life was just a matter. He said it's just a process of balancing the headaches, and that's just the way he viewed it. It was problems that you were dealing with all the time. It was not. He'd get enthused for very, very short periods of time about things. But mainly he was dealing with problems. People would come to him with problems, financial, personal, otherwise. He would try to help. He saw government as a series of problems. Party as problems. All it was problems he would deal with. The positive, he had no hobbies, really, see, if you think about it. He played gin, and he liked to play cards, but his hobbies were really wrestling with problems and talking about problems. He didn't fish or hunt or I don't know. Somehow those things are positive hobbies. The one hobby that he had in that vein could be looked at negatively too. He'd trim limbs off the trees, you know, do stuff like that, improve, and that in itself was a problem he was solving. You know, I don't know. It's just He enjoyed very few things, in my opinion, very few things. And he had trouble with most people because he could not really, he had very, very few friends, what I would call friends, because everyone came to him, they had motives and purposes that he was never sure. He could never be sure, you know, whether it was friendship or whether he had something they wanted, so to speak. The latter was mostly the case, too, you know. He had a few friends, wealthy guys that didn't need one to Rockefeller and didn't mind telling him so, and vice versa. Very few there. And I guess he got more satisfaction out of, and pleasure out of maintaining. Well, he got more pleasure out of Winrock Farms than anything. Because he kind of built that thing, and it was kind of a product of his own ideas and imagination quite a bit. It kind of grew as he wanted it to grow. He would build this building there and do this thing there. It's kind of a...
How did he feel after all of the work, money and resources and time and so on that he put into Arkansas? I mean, they came here from outside. In that first 10 years, and then the second 10 years, and then in 1970, after he's done all this, he's rejected.
Yeah. I asked him about that. He really didn't give me an honest answer. He kind of fuzzed it over. He gave me a kind of a platitude about it.
Did that contribute to his death?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, he died of cancer. I don't know to what degree, quote, heartbreaking, quote, contributes, but he did take it personally. It was a slap in the face. He didn't look at it in terms of a popular guy, Dale Uppers. He saw the people seeing him, as I think they did see him. They didn't like him, all of a sudden. They didn't want him as governor, at any rate. He took it personally, as I think they probably took it. You know, I mean, 65% or whatever, that's pretty heavy.
John, how do you explain Dale Bumpus? I mean, here's a guy, the three biggest names in Arkansas politics in the last 30 years, Orville Forbes, Winthrop Rockefeller, and William Fulbright, and he just trumped all of them.
It is the most amazing guy that you've ever been around. Have you been around him yet?
No.
Have you talked to him at all? First of all, he is a tremendous guy. He really is. He's a great guy. He's sharp as hell. He's a country lawyer, but boy, he's got lots of polish. Like Char. He says absolutely nothing. Walter, you would be amazed at how little that guy gets away with saying. He says nothing. He's not controversial. Hell, nobody can get a handle on him. They keep trying. Fulbright just worked like hell, picking holes in him and trying to. Could never get him unplugged. He just Mr. Bland, lots of smiles. Well, Mr. Fulbright, I have a great deal of respect for Senator Fulbright. I've agreed with him far more often than I disagree. I'm just offering you a choice. Here I am, and here he is. You want Mr. Fulbright? You'll let me elect him. It's just that kind of stuff. Just three cheers for Charlie all over again. He's a media man. I'll tell you, I'm going to give you a little philosophy of my own about